We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly interview show where top chess players, authors, content creators, and accomplished amateurs discuss their careers and share stories and chess improvement tips. Perpetual Chess is a part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network, and we'd like to give special thanks to our presenting chess education sponsor, Chessable.com. For more information about the show, you can go to PerpetualChessPod.com. But without further ado, let's get to the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We are here for a bonus pod. We are joined by an old friend of the podcast. He is a Chessable author of The Trompovsky Simplified and The Leningrad Dutch, and the author of the fantastic book, The Anon Files, one of my favorite chess, especially sort of modern chess history books, but books generally. And I interviewed our guest about that book a couple years back. You guys should go check it out in the archives. And definitely, if you like the backstory of top level chess, highly recommend the book as well as our prior interview. And our guest lives near Vikanzee, the venue, the coastal village where Tata Steel, the much referred to Wimbledon of chess, takes place. And he graciously offered to do some bonus pods discussing the tournament, sort of letting us chess fans know what it's like to be there. So I'm super excited to welcome him to the pod and discuss Tata Steel 2023. Welcome to FIDE Master Mikiel Ablin. Welcome back.
Thanks, Ben. Thanks for the intro. And as always, it's a great pleasure to be on your show. I've told you this before, but I'm a huge fan of your work. So it's also my pleasure.
Thanks. Well, the admiration is mutual. And it was so kind of you to offer to do this. You know, I live pretty far away here in New Jersey. I really want to get to Tata Steel someday. It's tough when you have kids. But in the meantime, this is the next best thing. And I imagine a lot of listeners might feel that way as well. So, of course, this tournament is ongoing. I suppose we should. So I'll just quickly mention the standings as we record here again in the top section. They're having a rest day. We're recording Wednesday morning, January 18th. I don't think we'll spend too much time on what I call the horse race aspect of this tournament because, number one, it's early. Number two, I know you all might not listen right when this comes out. So I think we'll discuss what it's like to be there, give some historical context, some games you might want to check out if you haven't already. But I will say, you know, in the open section, as we approach round five, Anish Giri and Abdu Satrov are tied for first with 3 out of 4. Surprising, I mean, not shocking to see Giri in first after beating Magnus Carlsen yesterday. But obviously, anytime Magnus isn't at the top, it's a mild surprise. Fabiano Caruana and Pragananda are tied for third with 2.5 out of 4. And then with 2 out of 4, we have Aronian, Irigesi, and Carlsen himself. And on it goes from there. Still early, still lots could change. So, Mike, you've been there every day. I should mention you've also been writing columns for The Week in Chess, a fantastic resource for covering chess and downloading games. Shout out to Mark Crowther. I know you and I are both fans of his work as well, Mikio. But my first question for you about this tournament is, what would someone watching at home who then showed up? And by the way, listeners, there's an open tournament, so you can go and play as well. It's like a chess festival. But what would someone who's going, say, to watch the Elite Chess, what would surprise them from what they watch on their screen to actually being there?
So I think the main thing is that when you enter the tournament hall, it's the spirit, the feelings that you get there. You immediately feel that you've arrived at a top tournament where you can also play your own game next to it. And after it, of course, you can watch the top players. But that spirit when you enter the tournament hall is a very special feeling. I've played in many tournaments around the world, and I immediately recognize that Tata feeling, and it's only there. It's so special. And I think that is the first part of the day. But then the other part is that as soon as the game, as the amateur game games end, what you see is that typically people start analyzing in the bar next to it and in one of the many pubs. And next, after that, people go for dinner together. And a lot of people who play the tournament stay in hotels. So they also, after dinner, go to bars and they start playing Blitz. And basically, this entire town lives, breathes chess for 2.5 weeks. And you feel it when you enter that very small town. It's a beautiful beach town in the summer, very crowded by tourists. But of course, in winter, completely empty. And then being taken over by chess lovers, chess enthusiasts. And it's really about that feeling that you will not get online. There, of course, you get fantastic commentary. You see the exciting games. But being on the ground, it's that atmosphere that makes it so special.
Hearing you describe it makes me want to be there even more, Mikio. Yeah, and our friends at New in Chess Books have a new book just out. You probably can see it there. The called Kings, Queens, and Rookies: The Tata Steel Chess Tournament, a Celebration of 85 Years. So this year is their 85 year anniversary. And I was reading some of the excerpted materials. I haven't gotten my hands on the book yet, but Erwin Lemie wrote a beautiful intro. And yeah, he describes when you're driving into the town, you see like banners of chess pieces. And my understanding is it's sort of like a beach resort town, but that's only in the summer. And as he jokes, no one goes in the summer. So I can only imagine that there's just chess players everywhere there in January.
No one's going there in winter, I think what you mean.
Right. Well, no chess players go in the summer no regular civilians go in the winter.
Yeah, exactly. No. And the weather was just horrible last week before the tournament started. It was stormy and windy. And everyone joked, including Anish Giri, oh, Wijkenzee is ready for the chess players with this weather.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, it's an indoor sport, so we might as well have the bad weather. Yeah, sometimes when I'm playing in a chess tournament, if the weather's bad, I'm like, well, if it was going to be bad, now is the time. Now, something else that Erwin mentions in this intro is that, again, there's a hotel where a lot of the players stay. And he says back in the day, even the top players would be congregating at sort of the hotel bar. You could see them doing postmortems late at night. I'm sure there's some legendary stories about some of the top players who enjoy the nightlife a bit. But he said that as chess has become more professionalized, you don't see that as much. But I am curious, Mikio, you have, from having written the Anon Files, having been in the chess world, being a strong player for so many years, you have personal relationships with some of these players. How much are you seeing of the top players? And then, for example, I know Anand's there helping some of the Indian players. Have you had a chance to talk with any of these players?
Yeah, I mean, you do see them, actually. So I think in the old days, some of the players in the A group were not in that sports mind that we have nowadays, as being as fit as possible and really being prepared for your game. So there are stories of players in the A group who would get drunk in the bar and barely find back their hotel. And I've seen that even as maybe 15, 20 years ago when I was also visiting the tournament. those days are definitely over. But what you still see is that a lot of these players like to go out for dinner to one of the restaurants. So, and Wijk aan Zee is a small place. There are maybe 10 restaurants, of which there are three or four where typically the top players go. So if you pick one of those three, four, you can run into Magnus Carlsen and having dinner there. Or like you said, Vizianant is still there. He's flying out tomorrow, I think. And any of the other top players. Occasionally, you see them being approached by chess fans for autographs. But most of the time, people leave them alone. They respect their privacy. It's also their time for a proper dinner. But of course, it's nice that you sit in the same restaurant as them, and that already gives the special feeling again. So in that sense, you still see the top players also at night, but then usually after 9 o'clock or so, they disappear. I think on the other hand, there are a lot of seconds in Wijk aan Zee, and I've heard the names. But of most of them, so I know Jan Gustafsson is there. I think he's now working for Anish Giri. Rames is there. Rustam Kazimjanov, he's working for Abdus Satorov. Who else? Srinath Narayan is there. Peter Heine Nielsen. And most of these people, you just don't see. They're kind of locked up in their hotel rooms, working nonstop. And the only other thing they do is, yeah, they join their player for dinner. But other than that, they don't come to the tournament hall at all. They watch from the hotel room, or even they take a few hours to nap. So the seconds you don't see so much. Fizzy is more of a special person. He's not helping the Indian players so much in this tournament. He was invited as guest of honor. And in that sense, he's helping the tournament organizing committee a lot with relationships with sponsors, both local Dutch sponsors, but I also became aware that there are international sponsors or potential sponsors who may want to do projects with FIDE who are flying in. And occasionally, Fishy is in the press room, but he's meeting a lot of these people and truly trying to help chess forward in attracting more sponsorship. I was quite lucky that I think it was Sunday when Fishy was in the press room, and I had a chance to catch up a bit with him, and we were analyzing some games. And there was someone standing next to him, and it took me almost 2 hours to recognize, because he's been away from professional chess for a long, long time. But after 2 hours, I figured out it was Jeroen Piquet. Not all your listeners may know who Jeroen Piquet was, but I think Jeroen made it to at least number 10 in the world rankings, maybe even higher. And then at some point he retired and he became the financial advisor of Joop van Oostrom, who we all know as the billionaire who was sponsoring the Monaco Amber tournaments.
Right.
And Jeroen moved then to Monaco. Unfortunately, van Oostrom passed away a couple of years ago. Jeroen is still not back in chess, but he did move back to Amsterdam. What I hear from the tournament director, Jeroen van den Berg, is that Piquet usually visits Wijk aan Zee because he can, just like myself, not withstand the passion of the town, of the tournament. So it was really nice to be there with Fischi and Jeroen Piquet to analyze some of the games while they were going on.
Yeah, and how long, I mean, I know the trains are amazing there in the Netherlands, but how long a drive is it from Amsterdam to Wijk aan Zee?
Maybe half an hour, maybe even a little bit less. So it's quite close.
Even closer than I thought. Yeah. What self-respecting chess player in Amsterdam could not stop by?
Yeah.
Well, that's fascinating stuff. I've got lots of follow-up questions based on all that information. But first, I did want to read the aforementioned Viswanathan Anand's tweet from 5 days back, which it shows him with some of the Indian players. And this is what made me think maybe he was coaching, but as you say, ambassador, whatever it is, he's happy to be there, because he wrote, hanging out with the boys, just revising the emoticon variations because they're sort of making funny faces in the picture. And then he says, happy to be at the 85th edition of Tata Steel Chess. It is our greatest tradition, and a January not in Wijk aan Zee is no January at all. So Yeah, nice warm sentiment there. And of course, you mentioned Jan Gustafsson, Peter Hein Nielsen, some of the other seconds. So, of course, I'm an avid listener of the Chicken Chess Club, and they've been discussing this tournament. And Jan recommended the Italian restaurant. I'm curious. So you mentioned the restaurants. For any listeners who do make their way there in future years, what is your favorite Vaik restaurant, Mikio?
It is that Italian restaurant, also because of certain memories that I've spent there long evenings where basically, I think this was 10 years ago when I was also producing reports for the Week in Chess, and some of the rounds would take a lot longer, and we would only get to the restaurant around 10 p.m. And in the Netherlands, that's quite late. Most restaurants would be maybe serving dessert or start to close. But that Italian restaurant has a special relationship with the tournament committee and also with tournament director Jeroen van den Berg. So then we could always get a table around that time, and we would have dinners all the way till 2 or 3 a.m. And I have special memories, including some of the chess players who also attended and had to play the next day. So this is what I still call the old life, where people were not maybe so much looking after the physical fitness as they are today. But that Italian restaurant has indeed a nice atmosphere. I know that Fischi goes there quite a lot. I think earlier this week he had dinner there with Pragnanda. And it's a favorite restaurant of many of the top players.
Yeah, I mean, and to be fair, like, I get what you're saying about, like, people don't want to stay out late anymore. But in my mind, part of it is partially perception as well, because the games start in the late afternoon there, right? Now, of course, chess players are notorious for having late sleep schedules, often waking up at 11 a.m. or noon or something like that. But anyway, to me, having a couple drinks wouldn't be a disaster, although certainly you don't want to overdo it. And, you know, maybe a doctor, I mean, certainly the people who study peak performance might beg to differ. I mean, they say that even one drink really affects your sleep schedule. But anyway, I do get a bit nostalgic for the older days hearing you discuss it.
No, and I think the amateurs are still very much treating it that way. Yeah, they see it as their holiday, and they definitely enjoy the nightlife as well.
Okay, yeah. And speaking of the amateurs, our next topic is sort of the Open tournament and the festivities. But Mikio, we do need to take a break and hear from our sponsors. So thanks. This has been amazing already. You're making me wish I was there. But anyway, we'll be back with more in a minute, listeners. Perpetual Chess is brought to you in part by aimchess.com. Aimchess has an algorithm that gathers your games from the major sites like chess.com and LeeChess and gives you actionable intel based on the patterns it detects. It can be how you do with certain openings, what aspects of the game you excel at versus need work at. And guess what? Aimchess has a new feature that you should check out right now, just in time for the new year. You can check out your year in review for 2022. You just enter your username and it gives you how many hours you spent chess, how many games you played, how you did with various openings. Lots of fun facts that the algorithm is able to gather. So be sure to check out aimchess.com. If you decide to try out subscribing, use the code PERPETUAL30 to save 30%. You can also use the link in the show description to try out aimchess.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And we are back. And as we alluded to, there is a big Open tournament. So anyone interested in attending could come in a future year. I should say, by the way, this should be obvious, but I'm not affiliated with Tata Steel as we sit here and do this infomercial for them. Just a chess fan, no more, no less. But anyway, this question is from recent Patreon sub Roy Lopes or Lopez. I'm not sure it's spelled L-O-P-E-S, obviously very close to a famous chess name. So I'm also not certain, Roy, if that's your real name. I believe he's from Brazil. But anyway, send me some nice messages and thanks for supporting the pod, Roy. And he wrote, How does the average age of the players look this year compared to previous years where you've witnessed it? Are the youngsters taking over in the Vaik Open section as they are in so many other tournaments?
Yeah, so I want to split my answer in both the professional tournament, but also the average age in the amateur tournament. If I look at the professional tournament, it's clear, I think that trend has been going on for the last 10 years, that top players are getting younger and younger. And I think definitely this year, Vaik has a fantastic field of different kind of playing styles, different kind of players in terms of where they are in their professional career. And it's a real clash what you see now, with also some of the youngsters moving up in the top of the field after four rounds, which could easily change again at a later stage. But so far, you see that some of the more what I would call arrived players are struggling a bit. That gives, I think, another good dimension to the tournament. At least I look forward to all these games and see how they fight each other and how they come up with new creative ideas. I especially see that the youngsters seem to be more creative in trying to get certain playing positions and then keep on playing. And with some of the arrived players, I see that there's a tendency to move quicker to equal positions and make a draw. It might also have to do with something that's well known in Vaik aan Zee, and that is that it's such a long tournament, 13 rounds, and that typically people do get tired at the end. And basically, you can make or break your tournament in the final four rounds. So maybe some of these more experienced players know that they can take it a bit easier in the early rounds, or they even should save some energy. And they are preparing to score later, where the youngsters maybe still have unlimited levels of energy, or just are not aware of how long the tournament is and go for it from the start. So we'll see. But I think in general, Tata has always done a great job in not just inviting the top players, but looking for a field that's yeah, I would say, always bringing up some new talents and getting more fighting chess. I am a little bit worried if I look at the B group, which usually has, I think, one promotion, maybe sometimes two in special circumstances. It's not obvious to me that there's any player at the moment there who would do well in this year's A group, let alone next year. So we'll see. But that could be a very tough tournament for the person who promotes to next year's A group.
Yeah, and for listeners not familiar with how it works, so there's the top section, which is the one that Magnus is playing in, and obviously rich history with many world champions. But in the challenger section, the top finishers then get to play in the masters section every year. So in a sense, to graduate, or at least to step up their level. I believe Gukesh won the challenger section last time. And yeah, some of the people, there are some young star players in the challenger section. Abhi Mishra from the United States, Aline Robers, who had a beautiful win against friend of the pod, Erwin Lemie. Sorry, Erwin, but I'm sure even though you would prefer to win, at least it was to a top young Dutch player, top woman number one already and 17 years of age. And Ramesh Babu Vaishali, Prague's sister, who, when I interviewed Jakob Augaard, he, of course, raved about her talent. And then we have the KG veteran, Adiban, the beast, Yakovar Sindavar, one of the top Uzbek players. So I get what you're saying. There's no clear ascendant star in that section, but I'm sure that any of them, I mean, you've got to take the chess player's perspective that, if you end up getting beat up by the strongest players, that's a great rite of passage, you know?
Yeah. By the way, you mentioned Erwin, and Erwin Lemie is a good friend of mine. And there's something very special that I saw happening this week. All of you may know also when you watch some of the live broadcast that when one of the top players loses a game, they tend to be very pissed off and frustrated. And in the press room, normally you can barely talk to these people. Yeah, they immediately run out and they're gone. Magnus, when he lost yesterday to Giri, was you could tell from his face that he was very frustrated and disappointed. And it's incredible that he composed himself before giving an interview for Norwegian TV, where it looked like he was still reasonably okay with the defeat. But immediately after that, he stormed out and he was gone. And this is with many of the players who lose a game. Even worse, if you lose two games in a row, then it's a very bad thing. But Erwin had a very bad start of the tournament. And yesterday he managed to win a game, but even there he started out against Misra from a very bad opening position. And at some point, Erwin lost his game to Eline Rubers, and Eline played fantastically. And of course, Erwin was also devastated, frustrated with his own play. And he comes into the press room, and someone, I'm sure by mistake, asked Erwin, can you do an interview? Now, of course, this is almost an insult when someone has lost so horribly. And Erwin, with a big smile, says, well, I think you better ask Eline. And
good way to handle it, yeah.
Yeah, and yeah. This was such a gentleman, nice way of handling the situation that it was really nice.
Yeah, and listeners, any listeners who have not heard the entire 300 episode plus back catalog, definitely I recommend my interviews with Erwin Lemie. He's a classy guy, and as someone who's been one of the Netherlands top players for many years, but also been the second of Anish Giri, I'm assuming you say Jan is there helping Anish. I'm assuming that's because Erwin is in the challengers section, but he has a unique vantage point as both a top player and a second. So he's well read and knows a ton about engines and the list goes on. So let's follow up a little bit more on what it would be like for someone to attend Mikio, because I have read that it's a festival. Now, when Sunway Citrus was happening, another top European tournament, obviously doesn't have quite the longest, as long a tradition as Vikense, but on social media, you see a lot of the events, beer making classes or table tennis tournament or whatever it is that they're doing. And obviously it's in South Spain, so weather looks beautiful, etc. Now, I did read that it's a chess festival there in Vike, but I'm not as familiar with what the events are. Could you shed any light on that, Mike?
Yeah, so and there's not like a single amateur tournament. There are different formats. There's it starts with a weekend. Then I think there's an 7-round tournament, and then it ends with a 9-round tournament. And you're only allowed to participate in one of the three tournaments because there are too many people who want to play, too many registrations. So you need to make a choice. And I forgot to answer earlier the second part when we talked about age span.
Oh, right.
Yeah, but what you see is that in these amateur events, in the first weekend, because it's a weekend, the average age is much lower, is a lot more young people than in the first week, which we're in now, simply because a lot of the young people have to go back to their studies or to their regular jobs again. So they only play the first weekend of the tournament. So if you're looking for a tournament with a lot of young energy, then that's definitely a great tournament. And I ran into a lot of people from that we know from the chess world who were also participating. So I saw the CEO from Chessable. He was, for example...
Geert was playing.
Yeah, Geert. He was playing in group six or something. I saw Peter Doggers from chess.com. He was playing. And many others. And I would say, I think, In terms of rating, people even without rating, people with ratings of 900 or 1,000 play all the way till the top level. And in a way, it's also very democratic because every time if you win your group, next year you promote to a higher group. So potentially, if you win 10 times in a row, you're playing against Magnus.
Yeah? Easy, nothing to it.
Easy. But I like the principle that it's possible.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. Yeah. We always want, you always want you always want clear rules. You know, you just want to know what you have to do. Like, it might be impossible, but but at least you know.
No, and I think if you're traveling, for example, all the way from the US to Europe to play this tournament, it's a nice story back at home that you're saying, well, I'm going to play this tournament because I want to play against Magnus in the future.
Exactly. And yeah, and another thing they mentioned in the Tata Steel excerpt that I read was that there were some years where fundraising was more of a challenge than others, but Magnus always accepts his invitation. And it's been mentioned on the pod before, but the prizes for the top section are not off the charts by any means. I think first place might be $20,000. I didn't check that. But in any event, these top players, they get reasonable conditions for coming, but they're not getting rich from coming to this tournament. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. Yeah, no. The Tata Steel Chess Tournament has never been a very rich tournament. They always need to control the budget. I think a couple of years ago, we still had an A, a B, and a C group. And
I forgot about that.
In a way that C group is gone now because of budget restrictions. And even for the top players, it's well known that the appearance fee, which is a major part of their income, at Tata is lower than at other tournaments. But like you said, it's just kind of the Wimbledon of chess. And that's why they love the playing conditions. That's why they accept their invitations. But it's definitely not the tournament with the best financial conditions for them. I think players also recognize especially if you no longer have the ambition to become world champion, but you are, say, in top 10, top 20 of the world. They realize that nowadays you can make a lot of money online, Instagram, Twitter, chessable courses, etc. And then it's also important that the chess fans keep seeing you playing. And that's another reason why players also love playing in Wijk aan Zee. It helps with their exposure. But then I noticed something very funny, is that because the players are so aware of their social media image, is that nowadays they do not only prepare for the tournament, but they also prepare 5 minutes before they give an interview. And that was completely new for me to see. Yeah, I mentioned earlier Magnus, who really was frustrated yesterday, but prepared 5 minutes before talking to Norwegian TV, where he looked very composed, and then he stormed out again. But the same is with Anish Giri, for example, who always checks first what the engine says, or checks with me in terms of what were the key points in his game. And he starts thinking about key messages before he actually gives his interview. And it's such an important new aspect of being a chess professional, your profile outside, that it makes total sense to me also to prepare for that.
That's fascinating. And of course, Giri is amazing at it. I mean, I've mentioned many times, I mean, he's very funny on Twitter, but he's also clearly just like a very savvy guy, you know? So
absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting stuff. Okay. Well, Michael, this has been amazing. I do want to take one more break, and then I do want to talk a bit about the actual chess games in the top section, because there have been some beautiful games. I mean, this is audio only, so we're somewhat constrained. But when we get back, we'll point you towards a few games just in case you miss them. Perpetual Chess is proud, as always, to be brought to you in part by Chessable.com. Chessable, of course, is known for their Move Trainer technology, which utilizes spaced repetition to help you remember tactical patterns and opening sequences. They have a huge library of courses for whatever aspect of your game you want to work on. Some of their new courses include a course on the Tirage Defense to D4, which is a good choice if you're looking for a dynamic opening against 1D4. It's by Super Grandmaster Jordan Von Forrest. Speaking of Super Grandmasters, former world champion and legendary trainer Rustam Kazymjanov has a course out on the C3 Sicilian. If you're newer to chess, be sure to check out friend of the pod, I am Andres Toth's 1D4 for beginners. And of course, they've got tactics courses too. They have stuff you can check out for free. So if you have not already, make sure you go to chessable.com and keep an eye on their ever-growing supply of quality chess courses. And we are back. And Mike, you've been writing, as far as I can tell. I was playing a tournament this weekend, so I caught up on the games as best I could, but I haven't been watching the broadcast the way I normally would. But I know that you've been writing recaps kind of focused on the chess for Mark Crowther's The Week in Chess website. So I'm curious if you have favorite games or overall impressions from the chess games you've seen in the top section especially.
Yeah, I think it's been a very fighting chess tournament. There's a trend that Magnus started 10, 15 years ago, not to do quick draws, like we used to know from, say, someone like Anatoly Karpov, who did that a lot. Magnus would play on and on. And I think that's a trend that you see now with all the young players. It feels like they're not nervous at all, no matter who they're playing against, except maybe when they play Magnus. But even yesterday, when you saw a beautiful win by Pragnanda against Ding Liren, you just see him pressing a very small advantage in an endgame from around move 30. And only around move 60 or 70, it converts into a full point. And I was very impressed by his stamina, by he kept on pushing and creating new chances. And maybe it's not easy to appreciate such a game if you just play over it. I think you need a coach or a trainer to explain it, or maybe a nice write-up in a chess magazine. But I was very impressed with how he managed to keep on putting the pressure.
Yeah, that's an important skill. I mean, that's Magnus's calling card, of course. So to see one of the young upstarts emulate that, and against Ding, against absolute legend. I have to say, it's hard to choose my favorite game that I've seen, but I think it probably is Ding's round one win against Gukesh as Black. Did you get a chance to check that game out, Mike?
Yeah, that was in Queen's Indian. Where basically Gukesh gave up his pair of bishops and then applied the wrong concept. It's funny that I discussed this with Anand, and basically I asked him the question: do you still can you see differences in terms of style between the different young players? Because I struggle with that, and the reason I struggle with that is that in the old days, Tal was known for attack and sacrifices. You could also tell a player usually by the openings they would play. Nowadays, it seems everyone is playing everything. And they can all play positional and they can all play attacking chess. But Anand told me that when you actually work with these players, you do notice that they have preferences in the decisions they make and the kind of positions they like and they like a little bit less. But you only find that out when you work with them. And Gukesh is then someone who has been raised by a trainer who doesn't like engines. So he's really an outlier in that sense, because as we know, everybody's working with engines nowadays. So from an opening knowledge point of view, he's maybe still a bit behind on some of the others. On the other hand, he's probably more creative and a lot of new ideas. And that's what you saw in this game against Ding Liren, that it was he tried to play very creative, but it backfired a bit, and Ding got a pair of bishops and managed to open the position with some beautiful moves. I would say moves that we as amateurs would not easily find. But once you see them played, you say, now I get
it. Exactly.
This is beautiful. And it's like a piece of artwork that's being explained to you. So that's a beautiful game. There was also a very nice tactical win by Anish Giri, where he sacrificed a knight and then a rook. Win. I think that was round three, if I remember correctly. I might be wrong. Maybe you have the data, Ben.
Round two, a Rogozin. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, and then of course the win of Anish yesterday against Magnus was also quite a spectacular game.
Yeah, it was. I mean, anytime Magnus loses in classical chess, it's noteworthy. But yeah, it was a beautiful game. Anyway, go on. Sorry.
Yeah, I think Anish was a bit bluffing afterwards when he said that he had not looked at this line since 2008, 2009.
Okay, I wondered about that. And I was also wondering, I heard some discussion referencing the round two game against Gukesh. Poor Gukesh, by the way. You know, in the U.S. in basketball, when you get dunked on, they call it being posterized. I feel like Gukesh kind of got posterized in game one and game two. I mean, really baptism by fire to have that beautiful game loss against Ding Liren in round one. And then boom, round two, Geary's playing like Morphy. But anyway, in that game where Geary played like Morphy, there was some discussion of how much of it might have been prep. Do you have any either insights or guesses?
It was, how do you say this? Nearly all prep.
Yeah.
The reason that I say that is that the position in which Anish sacrificed, he had not seen at home. So Black just made a move, King H8, that he had not studied at home. And he was sitting behind the board and he said, okay, I know this position and I know King H8 was maybe not in the first five or first 10 moves that the engine mentions. So it must be a bad move. The first move that came to his mind was to sacrifice the knight and then the rook. Why? Because he had seen those sacrifices in other lines that are very similar, but where the king is not on h8, but on g8, but other bad moves. So he was familiar with the sacrifice in very similar positions, and he knew that King h8 had to be bad. So that helped tremendously.
Okay, that's really interesting, because that's a very common feeling, even at the amateur level. Like, you know a move is wrong, but you don't know why. And that illustrates why grandmasters are always talking about you have to know the ideas of the position, because then you sort of have to reverse engineer the solution. And obviously with Geary's tactical acumen, he found rook takes e6 and, you know, put one in the history books.
Yeah, but I think Geary and some other chess players, Aronian is even better known for this, sometimes in their statements, they bluff a little bit. So yesterday there was this funny event that Caruana and Rapport wanted to agree a draw in a position before move 30. Rapport offered to draw, I think it was around move 20. And Caruana thought that this was not allowed according to the tournament regulations. So normally he would have declined, but he was ready to accept based on the position. And then because he was in doubt, he thought, let's ask the arbiter. And the reason he was in doubt was because Anish had told him earlier in the tournament that that rule didn't apply, that it was more like a guideline, but not an official rule, and you could ignore it. So Fabi asked the arbiter, and the arbiter says, well, it's better if you play on. So clearly, Anish was bluffing when he told Fabi earlier. Now, that game continued, and Rapport made some big mistakes, and basically Fabi felt obliged still to offer the draw before it got even worse, because, yeah, in a way, he accepted the draw, or was willing to accept the draw offer earlier. He never really accepted. He asked the arbiter. So that's why in the final position, you see a clear advantage for him. And he still offered a draw, because that's the gentleman thing to do if you want to accept a draw earlier. But I thought the example of Anish sometimes bluffing is clear.
So he's a troll, not just on Twitter, but in real life as well.
Yeah, he likes to make fun.
Yeah, but that's a classy move by Caruana for sure. Admirable. And I mean, obviously he does it just because he's a nice guy. But honestly, I feel like it's better, like, whatever, even though he's competing for first, he's only half a point back from the lead, but whatever extra value you get from that half point, like the value of being, you know, respected by your peers and your fans and known to be a good sportsman, greatly exceeds that half a point, in my opinion.
The other thing is, of course, you mentioned Gukesh, who got hit twice. What you see at the top level is that confidence, self-confidence plays a big role. If you play some good tournaments and things start working out for you, then your self-confidence increases and you tend to have more good tournaments. Many chess players also in the top 10, top 20 go through phases where they have some tournament victories and high levels of confidence. And then suddenly things don't work anymore and they drop a few places. For example, a well-known example is Maxime Fachier-Lagrave, who was world number two and now dropped a few places and is then coming back. And you see this with many others. Fabi has been higher. I think Wesley So has been higher in the past. And with Gukesh, it's a bit similar. I think since the summer, he had some results which were a bit disappointing. So he's in this phase where he lacks maybe a bit of self-confidence. And then if things start off badly in Tata, you become a target. So you can count on that the rest of the tournament will be quite tough for him. But at least he made two solid draws now. So that helps a lot. But confidence definitely plays a role. And it can, if you play one good game, it can suddenly be back. And if you play one bad game, it can also be gone. And that's what you saw basically with Vincent Keimer. He lost to Magnus in round two, I think, or round three. And it was a game where Keimer really lost from himself. He played below his normal level. There was not a clear threat, a clear logic he was following. And he was making it way too easy to Magnus. And he was also very disappointed with himself. And for him, it's now also the challenge to turn that around. And you saw that even yesterday, his opening was very flat, not inspired. So I think the rest day is coming at the right moment. And I look forward to what Vincent is going to do in the rest of the tournament. Because just like the others, he's a great talent. But he's had now this setback. And you lose a bit of your self-confidence in such a tough field. And that can be a very dangerous thing.
Yeah, it is interesting to see these tests that these youngsters have to go through. So, Michael, as we look to wrap up, I'm going to demand that we plug your Chessable courses before we go. But is there anything else you would say in closing about the tournament? And of course, I would love to do this again on, I believe, there's a few more rest days, but maybe one more rest day as we get to the home stretch, we can cover the tournament a bit more. But anything to add before we plug your Chessable courses?
Well, what I love the tournament. It's clearly all about the passion for the game. And in that sense, I would say if we're going to do another podcast, people, please try to find me on Twitter and just ask me the questions. Ask me questions about the games. Ask me things you want to discuss in this podcast. In general, I love the engagement. It's the spirit that we have in this tournament that I would like to see more of throughout the year. And it's the engagement as a chess community where I think we can still work on. And whether it's Chessable or Twitter, I usually try to respond within 24 hours. And I think I look forward to the rest of the tournament. There's a lot of fighting going on. I have very high hopes of Abdusattarov. I think Abdusattarov, sorry, mispronunciation. I think he has a fantastic trainer in Rustam Kazimjanov. I'm very impressed with the two games he's won. I think the first one he won in a difficult rook ending where Rapport made a mistake. I mean, Richard Rapport is not a weak player at all. And to outplay him in a rook end game is very impressive. And I think the way he won yesterday again, Abdusattarov, again, was very impressive with this maneuvers with queen and rook. So if you want to play over another game, that is maybe also a very nice one to play out on a board with pieces, set them up at home and see how he managed to do that. The engine will probably show that there are a couple of moments where Black could still keep the position in balance. But overall, I thought the pressure is still on. And if you try to defend such a position with Black, it's probably hopeless. So very impressive. So I look forward to what's going on there. But I think also in the challenges, there's so much going on. Of course, I'm looking forward to Eline Roemers, how she's going to continue to perform. Before we started this, I had a look at her game, and she's already clearly better against Dutch fellow man Thomas Beertsen. So let's see how she will. But she's clearly a huge talent. I'm rooting for my friend Erwin Lamy that he will somehow try to find his form back and try to start making decent moves. It's a long tournament, so maybe next time we talk, Ben, he's in a much better position. But there's so many storylines in this tournament that I really look forward to the rest.
Yeah, me, I do as well. And it's been quite illuminating to hear your perspective. You know, obviously, you know so much about the chess world, and to have you there and to offer to do this is greatly appreciated, Mike Yu. So before we let you go, I already mentioned the Anand Files. If you're into chess history and you haven't read it for some reason, you must read it. Your chessable courses, I have to admit, Mike Yu, I'm not a Tromp player or a Dutch player. In fact, even though the engine always says my position is good against the Dutch, I never feel like I know what to do, but your courses are very, very well reviewed on Chessable. Anything else you would like to add about them before we say our goodbyes?
No, I mean, in general, the courses are made in the same spirit as I write for the Week in Chess, which I, by the way, also do for free. The courses, everything is going to charity, which is the Max Over Center in Amsterdam.
So awesome.
Yeah, this is the museum, and I'm a board member, also non-paid board member. And really try to support that. And for that, I use the reviews of my courses. And I truly love the engagement with amateurs. I feel that there is a lot of chess material out there. And I've heard this also in some of your other interviews, Ben, with, for example, Noel Studer and Ramesh, which basically teach us as adult improvers the wrong type of things. And I have a passion for being open, being transparent, and really trying to help people. So, for example, on Chessable, I think for many people, the move trainer is maybe not the best thing. But I love the fact that I can keep the courses up to date, and that on a daily basis, one-to-one, I can give people specific advice on whether a course is the right thing for them, whether what to do a certain opening line, etc. And that's what I love so much about the chess community. In a way, we all love the same game.
Yeah, and I get what you're saying. What Noel Studer, probably what you're alluding to, certainly what comes to mind for me, is it all comes back to this idea of if you memorize a move and you don't understand it, it can be quite problematic. It can actually be counterproductive at times. Now, I don't consider that Chessable's fault, but that's something to be cognizant of when you're memorizing. And having just played a tournament this weekend, I had a situation where I was trying a new opening. I played a dynamic line. And as I'm looking at the line over the board before I play it, there's one sort of obvious move that I know isn't the best move, but I don't know why, and I'm sacking a pawn. And that was not a good feeling where I'm sacking this pawn. And if they play the obvious response, I know it's bad, but I'm not Anish Giri. You know, I'm a 2100 player. Yeah. So I've got to figure out what to do. And I ended up not even going into the variation didn't happen, but it was a reminder that when you do, you've got to, you don't just blindly click through the moves. Make sure it's better to learn fewer moves, but really understand them, as opposed to just sort of try to fire hose dump everything into your brain.
Well, that and ask the author. Ask me.
Yeah.
That is because I recognize this from my own games when I play. You have all kind of questions and doubts that you didn't have when you were studying it. So I always tell people who buy my course, ask the question or show your game on your discussion forum. And I'm happy to have a look at it. I think the engagement is one of the most powerful but also underestimated attributes of Chessable.
Well said. Yeah. And I should say, by the way, the explanation was in the course. I had done the thing where I memorized the move and not the explanation. So it was fully on me, but I'm sure I'm not the only one who's had that experience. All right. Well, Mike, I'll link to your Twitter bio. And we'll try to round up some questions and hopefully do this again. But this has been fantastically illuminating, and it's always good to talk chess with you.
Thank you, Ben. Likewise.
Okay. Enjoy the spectacle. enjoy the rest of the tournament.
Thank you.
Okay. Take care. Thanks to everyone who helps make Perpetual Chess possible. Big shout out to my producer, Matthew Passy. I'd also like to thank the Blue Wire Podcast Network, with whom we are proud to be affiliated. Be sure to follow us on social media, Benefishial1 on Twitter, at Perpetual Chess on Instagram, or you can join the Perpetual Chess Facebook group. You can email me, ben@perpetualchesspod.com. And of course, last but not least, I'd like to give major thanks to the Perpetual Chess Patreon and PayPal supporters. Those who choose to join that community based on their level of support can do things like submit questions for guests of the show, have access to live Zoom Q&A lectures with grandmasters who often have appeared on the show, going over chess games, answering questions, stuff like that. And you can even get access to ad-free perpetual chess if that's your preference. So, but most of all, thanks to everyone for listening, and we will catch you all on the next episode.
Podcast Network.